I would like to now talk to Terry Tempest Williams. She is an author whose latest book is Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Terry Tempest Williams, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
I loved this book. I've up till 4 a.m. reading it last night, but there are two sections of the book, and the first is about prairie dogs, and the second is about Rwanda, and I hope we can talk about the connections between them in a little bit, but let's start with the prairie dogs. You write about the myth of rugged individualism in the West, and then contrast that to the prairie dog as a symbol of community. Tell us about the ways in which prairie dogs form communities and represent communities in their ecosystems.
You know, I think the prairie dogs, be it the Utah prairie dog, white-tailed, black-tailed, Gunnison's, or Mexican prairie dogs that are, you know, indigenous to North America, have a great deal to teach us about community. They really hold a Pleistocene mind. They're a keystone species responsible for over 200 other animals, you know, from the black-footed ferret to burrowing owl to rattlesnakes, to pronghorn. They create habitat with their paws, burrows. I always see their mounds rising upward like a fist. And, you know, I think they really are the equivalent of the untouchables in India. We think they're expendable. You know, I know that my own family viewed them as pop guts. They were target practice. But, you know, I think if we really look more deeply, they're an animal that understands community, understands interrelatedness, and have a keen sense of communication.
Prairie dogs have lost the vast majority of their habitat in a very short time. What have been the forces displacing them?
You know, the forces displacing them have been, I believe, prejudice, cruelty, ignorance, and arrogance. And whether it's developers today, you know, raising the ground, prairie dog towns, so that they can put up their new developments, to a long, long history of government prejudice that involves poisoning, gassing, shooting. They've really been the target of our own animosity. I think as important as what is displacing them is those organizations that are advocating for them. And I feel such a debt, Mary Charlotte, for Wild Earth Guardians, particularly Nicole Rosmarino, Lauren McCain. I can't believe the kind of fierce work and advocacy that this Santa Fe organization has done. And I can tell you in Utah, we are really in their debt.
They've replaced Groundhog Day. Sometimes, actually on this show, on Groundhog Day, we talk about Prairie Dog Day, and I think they've done a wonderful job in helping bring attention to prairie dogs. They're such amazing animals, and there's a wonderful and very poignant moment in your book where you talk about, and I can't remember exactly when this is, but some government agency tells Native people that they can get rid of the prairie dogs to make room for grazing or farming or something else. And the Native people say, no, if the prairie dogs aren't there, then there will be nobody to remember the rain. Am I quoting that correctly?
Yeah, it's a powerful story. When I worked on the Navajo Reservation, Barry Tolkien told me that story, and I heard it from one of the elders. It was in the 1950s on the sheep production program. The Army Corps of Engineers came to one of, you know, the council meetings. They faced the Navajo elders, the Diné, and they said, we're removing the prairie dogs because they're causing problems on the range, so to speak, both for sheep and cattle because of the burrows. And the Navajo elders turned to them and said, if you take away all the prairie dogs, there will be no one to cry for the rain. Well, you can imagine what the government officials thought, and they went ahead with their reduction program. Within a matter of months, without the prairie dogs to aerate the soil, to create a porous situation that could hold the water, the rain, it became hardpan. And, you know, I just think that's such a powerful lesson for the interconnectivity of life and what prairie dogs really hold for the grassland community, the sagebrush steppe in the arid West.
You were talking about people, even in your family, who like to shoot prairie dogs. What's that all about? I mean, I understand people wanting to develop the land and make shopping malls or railroad tracks or whatever, but just simply shooting them for fun?
You know, it's hard to imagine. It's a mindset. Like I said, I see this in my own family. And, you know, when you look at the kind of shooting sprees that go on around prairie dogs, whether it's in Colorado or in the Dakotas, it's pretty terrifying. You know, these rifles, it's sport. You know, how far can they shoot? There's something called the Red Mist Society because of what's created with these high-powered long-distance rifles that just obliterate the prairie dog. I think the thing that's so hard for me to understand is, you know, these are not varmints. These are not untouchables. They are sophisticated family members that, you know, have these relationships just as we do. And, you know, I often wonder if people thought about them in a more complex, rational, real way, could they proceed with the killing? You know, Mary Charlotte, you asked about the connection. You know, how is it that you can have a discussion of prairie dogs in the same book with the Rwandan genocide? And my sense on that is that whether it's the extermination of a species or the extermination of a people, in this case, prairie dogs and Tutsi, the impulse is the same, which is predicated on prejudice, cruelty, ignorance, and arrogance, as we talked about before, with issues surrounding power and justice.
There's a saying that an enemy is a person whose story you haven't heard. And I think when I read about the prairie dogs, and also your couple of weeks that you spent with wildlife biologists observing the prairie dogs, you get to know their stories in a way that really you couldn't have imagined. And although they're not human, they have their stories, they have their dramas, they have their own language.
That's right. You know, and John Hoagland, I had the privilege of working with him for 2 weeks, and 2 weeks is nothing, but I have to tell you, it was everything. You know, 16 hours sitting in this tower watching these kinds of relationships on the ground with the Utah prairie dog, one of the last wild populations, you know, in the world. And to see the kind of empathy as a scientist that he conveys, the kind of rigor. And then, as you say, you know, one of the dominant females, she was known as Head Wide Apart because of her markings. I found after 4 or 5 days calling her Madam Head Wide Apart, seeing how she engaged in communal nursing, you know, you can say, well, that's so anthropomorphic, it's so sentimental. But on the other hand, I think of the philosopher Mary Midgley, and she says, you know, the ultimate act of anthropomorphism is to assume that animals don't feel. I mean, any of us who live with animals, dogs, cats, know that there's a consciousness there. And, you know, I think until we can embrace this larger, wider world, we'll be destined to continue in acts of cruelty and war.
We're talking to Terry Tempest Williams. Her new book is called Finding Beauty in a Broken World. The central metaphor of the book is the mosaic, and the book itself is a mosaic, in a way, of ideas and images, and it's the reader's job to step back and see the big picture from the many pieces that you, the author, have put together. And I was thinking about that whole mosaic metaphor. It starts out with you going to Italy and actually studying mosaic making. If you are designing a mosaic, you have to see the big picture from the beginning. Did you have a sense of the big picture before you started writing this book?
Mary Charlotte, I had no idea where I was going. And I, you know, Mary, Helena Cixous, she's this French deconstructionist. But I love when she says the only book worth writing is the book that threatens to kill you. And I did not know where I was going this book. In many ways, this is a book of faith. I only knew that as a writer, I had lost my own sense of poetry. You know, I started writing this book shortly after September 11th. I made a choice to speak out against the rhetoric that I saw was shutting down our country in the name of fear and war. I heard myself saying things like, you know, there are many forms of terrorism and environmental degradation is one of them. But I think the thing that scared me after this first year, after September 11th, is I heard my rhetoric becoming as brittle as those I was opposing. And I was in Maine. I went down to the water, call it a plea or a prayer, and I just said, give me one wild word, and I will follow it. And the word that came back to me was mosaic. And I took it literally. And as you said, I went to Italy, to Ravenna, where these beautiful Byzantine mosaics, these bejeweled ceilings, decorate the ceilings of the churches. And in this workshop, you know, I learned the first rule of mosaic is the play of light. You know, that there is perfection and imperfection. That, as you said, we have to step back and see the big picture. And I think as a Westerner, when I came home and was working with prairie dogs, that metaphor, that idea of mosaic translated very powerfully as an ecological mosaic. And then I think what one can never know is, you know, 5 years later you find yourself in Rwanda creating a genocide memorial with Hutus and Tutsis literally out of the rubble of war.
So tell us about that. How did you end up in Rwanda and what was your work there?
My brother had just passed away from lymphoma, and a friend of mine, Lily Ye, she's a Chinese-American artist, probably barely 5 feet, one of the most fierce, powerful people I've ever known, came to Salt Lake. We had dinner. She put her hand on my knee and said, will you accompany me to Rwanda? Will you be my scribe? I looked at her and said, no. She didn't take her eyes off me, and I heard myself say yes. I think I was scared to go to Rwanda. I was afraid to face my own complicity in doing nothing, which we did, nothing, in this country in 1994. You know, while almost a million Tutsis were murdered by hand by Hutu extremists in 100 days, we in this country debated for 3 months whether or not these acts constituted genocide. But it changed my life, and I think on some fundamental level I knew if I didn't go, I would be saying no to my own humanity.
There was a quotation that somebody said, the devil came into the churches and murdered every Tutsi. There's a story that you tell where you saw the face of the devil in a certain way in a person named, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but Kawawa?
Right.
Could you tell us that story?
You know, I don't know if I believed in evil before Rwanda, and that's a really hard thing for me to say. I just don't think in our American psyche, imagination, there was no way to really accommodate the horrors that took place there, with their roots in colonialism and racial preference. Hutus and Tutsis speak the language, they marry one another, and suddenly, you know, in a colonial rule, preference is given to the Tutsis because they have more Western characteristics. That's in a nutshell some of the seedbed of this. They were given more power, resentment builds with the Hutus. Anyway, to make a long story short, we found ourselves in what's known as Gachacha. It would be the equivalent of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's where in the village there are eight, or in any town in Rwanda, it's mandatory, these local trials, Gachacha, grass courts, are held. Eight judges, the community there, they must be there. Perpetrators come before the community, tell their story of who they killed, how they killed, and where. If the community believes that they show proper remorse, they are folded back into the community. If they believe they are lying, they're sent back to jail. In this process in Gisenyi, there was a genocidaire named Kawawa, who was responsible for killing tens of thousands of Tutsis. He had impeccable integrity, which is hard to imagine with murderers. But he told the truth. He told who he killed, how he killed them, and where. So after these trials would take place, they would bring Kawawa in, no chains, no shackles, no protection, and he would say, yes, this man killed, this man's telling the truth, and that would be that. I was the scribe for the barefoot artists. After we heard these trials, one man was folded back into community, told the truth, another man was not. Kawawa had given his, you know, overlay. I was asking the judge how to spell their names. And then I said, how do you spell Kawawa? And all of a sudden I heard across the table, K-A-W-A-W-A. I look up, there is Kawawa. There was no white in his eyes. He was looking through me in a way I had never experienced. Louis Gakumba, our translator, ran up and said, what's going on? And I just said, Kawawa just spelled my name. I mean his name. I heard this Freudian slip. Suddenly, all hell broke loose. He grabbed the AK-47 from the police and the guard and tried to shoot all of us. Luckily, the gun jammed. He was tackled to the floor. And then he got up and walked out. No shackles again, no controls, nothing. And it was terrifying. You know, I was sitting there thinking, do I shake this man's hand? How do I make peace? You know, it's not to happen. If there is a charisma of evil, we faced it that day. What we were to later learn is that Kawawa, in that moment, knew that there were American journalists there, artists, and he wanted to create an international spectacle, that the genocide is not over, that the Hutu extremists are still in control. And that night, one of the Gacaca judges came and said, we took Kawawa to the highest level prison. We realized we had relied on him in the name of expediency. And then he turned to us and said, this is a man who cut out the hearts and ate them of every person he killed.
And who you were a foot away from and looked into his eyes and saw that thing. And I think, you know, when we talk about, as you say, we Americans talk about things that most of us have never seen, like genocide. It's hard to fathom that there is an energy known as evil, but you've seen it.
You know, the other thing, and Louis Gakumba, you know, he's 26 years old, he's so wise. Afterwards, he said, look at your hands, look at your hands. He said, on this side, angels, on this side, devils. And how do we put these two hands together in the name of prayer? He told this remarkable story, Mary Charlotte, of a woman who had witnessed the Interahamwe, the Hutu extremists, murder, chop, every one of her children, 11 children, and her husband. She was coming back from the market. She saw the man who killed them. Years later, he came back and underwent Gacaca. He faced this woman and apologized. He said, I accept everything I have been charged with. She stood up in the center of community and said, I know you killed my family. I watched you murder my children. She said, I am alone now. I forgive you. And I am taking you into my home, and you will now be my son.
That's a story that, again, it's something that I don't know how many of us can even imagine being that woman and taking that person in.
It's unfathomable to me. You know, and I think that idea, when I said Kawawa spelled my name, I mean his name, you know, this is what we're capable of. I think we're capable of acts of greatness and acts of tremendous cruelty. And how do we find beauty in a broken world? And I think the exploration for me, Mary Charlotte, in this book that took 8 years in the living, is that finding beauty in a broken world is creating beauty in the world we find. I think that's our challenge in these fragmented, disconnected times.
And as you say, I mean, if one group is capable of genocide, we all are. We have the hands of angels and devils. But what protects us is what? It's precisely that consciousness and giving words to it and talking about it the way you're talking about it in your book and the way maybe the book will spawn conversations.
I hope so. You know, and I look at our history in America, you know, the genocide of Native peoples. I look at what's happening with the prairie dogs and groups like Wild Earth Guardians who are making such an extraordinary difference. And I have to say, you know, when you look at the consciousness that is alive in Santa Fe, I find that extremely hopeful, where we really are making these connections and seeing these patterns that lead us to a place of compassion, not cruelty.
We're talking to Terry Tempest Williams, author of the new book, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. You write about a woman who was doing guerrilla conservation work in Rwanda and the importance of linking the surviving wilderness that we have on this planet to cultural values as well as ecological ones. How does that work in Rwanda, and how does that work in other places?
You know, one of the first ecologist to do work in Rwanda making these connections was George Schaller, and then you look at the lineage with Diane Fossey, you know, who really wrote eloquently about making this connection, that there will be no guerrilla conservation until there's conservation within the villages and sustainability. I think we're just now coming to this in the last decade, you know, certainly in the interior West. You know, you look at Tom Udall, who's running for Senate. He understands this. You know, his father, Stuart Udall, as Secretary of Interior, understood this. So I think, you know, this is where we are evolving to. And, you know, I was thinking about in Santa Fe, you know, to me the symbol of that connectivity is that beautiful bronze statue that you have with St. Francis, you know, speaking to the prairie dog. It's this intersection between both the human and the wild, the cultural and the ecological. And how do we bridge these two worlds into a vision of sustainability? You know, how do we expand our sense of community to include all life forms, rocks, rivers, human beings, and animals? And again, you know, I think organizations such as Wild Earth Guardians are helping us make that pattern. And certainly in Rwanda, Paul Kagame, who's now the president, has a program called Vision 2020. And what's interesting is it is a vision of sustainability. It's a vision looking at population. It's a vision looking at deforestation and strategies that create a more viable existence within the human communities with a bow and respect toward the wild communities. You know, the other genocide in Rwanda that's never spoken of is erosion. There's more work for the Red Cross right now with whole hillsides and villages slipping away. And you have the sense, you know, that Rwanda is a country that literally is slipping away just because of the deforestation, the rain, the steepness of the slopes. So it's again, as you say, it's all related.
And yet here in the West, as you say, many of the Western and Midwestern states are getting D's and F's in their efforts to protect prairie dogs and even follow the guidelines of our own government.
Again, we're just so arrogant. You know, it's the only word I can use, and ignorant. When I look at the beautiful report from the borough, the forecast of the prairie dog that Lauren McCain worked on, you're right. And again, prairie dogs are not creatures that we value. You know, they will, you know, people will say they're not charismatic species or they're expendable, they're rodents. But without the prairie dog, there is no varied world. I mean, when you think about all of the different species that are dependent upon them, and as you point out, you know, the incredibly complex communication system that they have, how can we avert our gaze to their demise? In the same way, how did we avert our gaze to a genocide in Rwanda? You know, in that phrase, never again, I often think it's never, comma, again. Here we see it over and over. We turn our backs.
In the part about the prairie dogs where you spend all this time observing them, and there's pages and pages of observing even the technical names of these prairie dogs and their numbers and stuff like that. It's pretty interesting. But you say something that I loved, which is time is intimacy. And, you know, there's this incredible virtue in just sitting and watching and observing. And that's a different pace than most of us live. It's probably a different pace than you're living right now, doing a book tour and running around on airplanes and stuff to come to Santa Fe. But I'm wondering, when I think about that, has time become a luxury? Or do we still, I mean, you know, maybe if we turn off the TV, there's still the time to really, really slow down. How do you see that?
I think that's such a good point. And, you know, in many ways, this book is about stillness, that time is intimacy. And again, we live in this fractured, fragmented world that we're all complicit in. You know, my father, I have to tell you, who's the Marlboro man without the cigarette, you know, he read this book and he said, "Terry, the prairie dog section is so boring that no one will get through it. And if they do continue, it's such a downer, they'll be sorry they did." And, you know, I laughed, but I just said to Dad, you know, I wanted to create on the page a sense of stillness. I wanted to create on the page a sense of patience, because in many ways, what may be most endangered and threatened is our capacity to be present, to focus, to slow down, to observe. And I think what the prairie dogs continue to teach me is, you know, how do we stay present? How do we slow down? And that the very act of witnessing is not a passive act. That if we allow ourselves to witness their world, we enter in, and our consciousness shifts. And if our consciousness shifts, then I believe our actions change also.
We're talking to Terry Tempest Williams. The book is called Finding Beauty in a Broken World. I mean, another thing about the prairie dogs is that there are things that they do that are not easily explained. You end up calling them prayer dogs. They, for example, there's a gesture of standing up and facing the sun, which is kind of like what people do in prayer.
You know, you couldn't make this up, and every morning we were in our observation posts before dawn, and then you would just watch. You would watch the light strike the prairie dog village, and then slowly, one by one, each prairie dog would rise, stand out of their burrow, and face the sun, Mary Charlotte. Would you believe me when I tell you their palms are pressed together, and they would just stand in that gesture of stillness, facing the sun, watching the sun rise for maybe 30 minutes. And then at the end of each day, that gesture is repeated. So each prairie dog would return to its home burrow, stand, face the setting sun in a different direction, palms pressed together. I mean, it was uncanny. And, you know, my job as a research assistant to John Hoagland was just to simply observe what I saw. That is what I saw.
How did the prairie dog biologists explain that, if they did?
At one point I just said, John, and he goes, I know. He said, you're worried about not being scientific enough, you know. And the joke with all of this was, you know, not to say the C word, which was cute. I mean, it's just, prairie dogs, they take your heart. You know, they just, it's impossible not to fall in love with them. And I don't know what the answers are. You know, there has to be a survival strategy. You know, what behooves the prairie dog to stand still before their burrows before the ending of a day? I don't know. I don't know if John knows. But the research that he's compiled on the Utah prairie dog in the last 10 years is astonishing. And I have to say, you know, all is not rosy. When you look at prairie dog population, there's infanticide. There is violence within the village. And so, again, we see ourselves. But there's tremendous communication skills. There's tremendous interconnectivity between the burrows. They outsmarted us all the time. You know, we would put these orange cones into the burrows to see where the entrances are. It became a joke. You know, how can a baby prairie dog outsmart, you know, a human being? Over and over again, they outsmarted me.
Well, there's this funny moment where they all disappear and you say they're having a meeting to try to figure out how to get around our traps. I think it's important to also mention, because that prairie dogs are a big conversation in Santa Fe with respect to new development, with respect to there have been instances of poisoning prairie dogs and so on. When they're relocated, they don't survive very well. People think relocation is some big answer, but as you told us, it really isn't.
You know, again, these parallels, there's a 10% success rate in relocation. It's not the answer. I think the answer is protecting and preserving their habitat. I think the thing that was most compelling, and it was really, again, Nicole Rosmarino that showed me this, that when you take prairie dogs off of their home ground, and relocate them, they cease to speak. And if a prairie dog loses his voice, it loses its capacity to survive. I saw this with the Tutsi, with the refugees in the refugee camps. When you see displaced people, they lose their voice, they lose their sense of community, they lose their power. And I think that was one of the things that was so compelling when you think about, you know, what characteristics do we share as animals? We are mammals, and we seem to forget that. You know, the one thing that we haven't talked about that brought great hope to me is how art can become a spark for social change. And I would say, you know, the art of conservation, or in the case of Rwanda, art such as painting. Lily Yeh, an artist in the village, invited the children to create murals. Suddenly, this very gray, bleak, genocide survivors village of refugees who were not connected in the name of community suddenly became a community as the children painted their houses. What was once gray became alive with color, a rainbow of color. You had Cheshire cats. You had flower angels. You had cows with 14 udders. Suddenly, the community gelled around art. It was the same with the genocide memorial. These women, these mothers, they were hiding the bones of their children, wrapped in fabric underneath their beds. They had no place to bury their beloveds. And with Lily and the women, they constructed, created this plan for a genocide memorial, literally made of mosaic. When those mothers could finally give their children and their families proper burial, there was a peace that ensued. Not that they will ever forget, but at least their dead were honored. This happened through art. And I think, again, we forget how art can become the spark for social change, that beauty is not optional, but a strategy for survival.
The stories you tell of the children whom you meet in Rwanda, they're so ready to be alive and be joyous and even to sing. The first thing they do is surround you and say, teach us a song.
It's true. And the pitiful thing is, the only song I could remember was, the big red letter stands for the Jell-O family. The big red letter stands for the Jell-O family. It's Jell-O, yum, 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 Jell-O pudding, yum, 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 Jell-O tapioca, try all three. I mean, this Mormon camp song, this corporate ditty. Do you know how horrifying that is?
But, was so funny.
You know, at least the children were laughing. And I remember Louis, our translator, you know, just turned to me and said, you cannot rob the children of their joy. So it is this quality of resilience, you know, that I think makes us human. It's the quality of resilience that has allowed the prairie dogs, against all odds, to survive. And I think there's tremendous hope in that.
We're talking to Terry Tempest Williams. It's so funny that a book like this, which has storylines, but it doesn't have a storyline the way a novel does exactly, but that mosaic mode of construction draws you in, and there are moments that seem unrelated to the moment that came before in the book, but then it's like you describe the making of a mosaic where you make a stem that's green, but then you have to put a bright blue dot on it that when you look closely doesn't fit, but when you stand far away, that's the glint of light on the stem of the flower. And in a way, the prose works similarly.
I so appreciate you seeing that, Mary Charlotte. I mean, you dream of readers such as yourself. And, you know, the book is full of risks and landmines in that way. There are no chapters. There's no titles, no headings. And, you know, in the last year, I decided to unmoor the whole text because for me, you know, I don't know about your life, but I don't have neat chapters and, you know, perfect endings and breaks. And I just thought, you know, what would it be if I tried to construct a book as a mosaic is? As you say, some with jagged edges, some that are seamless, some with that disturbance of color against another. And so in that sense, you know, this whole book, I think, is an act of faith. And I love the idea that in times of war, we can create something. You know, I think that's what makes us human, is our capacity to create as well as to destroy.
There's a very beautiful part at the end where you talk about Louis Gakumba, who is your friend in Rwanda, who basically makes himself your son. And that's another risk that you take that you had never taken before in your life.
I don't even know how to talk about it. You know, as you say, Louis Gakumba was our translator. I met him when he was 22 years old. He is a genocide survivor. You know, he had not been to school since third grade because of the war. He speaks six languages, taught himself English. The most extraordinary, wise soul. And he never asked anything of us. But I knew how badly he wanted to go to school. And he is so smart and so hungry for knowledge. And to make a long story short, we were able to find him a scholarship at the Salt Lake Community College. And so we were working with him, with the State Department, to get him a visa. It's very hard in Rwanda to secure a visa. They kept saying, you know, his ties to Rwanda aren't strong enough. He doesn't own land. He doesn't have money. And it was like, excuse me, what genocide survivor owns land? They're doing what they can to survive, period. And you know, let's talk about what he does have: faith, tenacity, grace. You know, he's been translating for all of these NGOs. Anyway, it was really Louis himself. He spent 10 hours a week hitchhiking and just would sit in front of the consulate's office. Very quickly, you know, I got a call saying his visa's been turned down 3 times. If it's turned down a 4th, he'll never be able to come or leave the country. You know, will you sign these papers and will you, can your name appear on his visa and passport? And I said, of course. Brooke and I, my husband, we went to Rwanda again to work with the Barefoot Artists on this project. I called the consulate and said, where are we on Louis Gakumba's visa? She said he picked it up yesterday. We went down to the village, and Mary Charlotte, unbeknownst to us, we found ourselves in a transfer ceremony with his parents. Can I tell you, it was the most humbling moment. And, you know, Brooke and I made a conscious decision not to have children and to suddenly, you know, find yourself with this beautiful young man and his mother, one of the most spiritual women I have ever met, who survived the genocide. All 7 of her children survived, who said to me as she took my hands, I am his birth mother. You are now his developmental mother. Please see that he is educated so that he can come back to Rwanda and lead. It was just, it was so humbling, and still is. And he is here with us. He's in school at Salt Lake Community College. He's so excited. And after he had been here 2 months, he turns to me and he said, Mom, you seem a bit more stable. And I just, you know, I just think he had no idea the family he was coming into. But it's a wonderful reconfiguration of family, again, a mosaic that you could never have anticipated.
You say somewhere in the book that we can no longer let nature take care of itself. And I was thinking about, because we did a program where we were talking about evolution and all these things happen that are catalysts for evolution, like earthquakes and tidal waves and meteorites and so on. And human beings really are providing, through the what we think of as catastrophes, great big changes that spur evolution. Why can't we let nature take care of itself?
I mean, I think that's a complex question. You know, on one hand, nature will take care of itself. We're seeing this with climate change, and it may not be the result we hope for. But I just think it's so complex, and we have such a heavy hand. We have to make choices. And, you know, I think, again, I hate to belabor the point, but when you look at advocacy groups like Wild Earth Guardians, when you look at a biologist like Nicole Rose Marino, if we did not have them advocating for prairie dogs, if we did not have them challenging the ordinances for the gray wolf in the state of New Mexico, we are going to lose these species when we have an administration that is this hostile to the diversity of life, you know, that's trying to undermine the environmental laws that have been held as sacred, you know, for the last 30, 40 years. When you have the Endangered Species Act that is being knocked down, the fact that they don't want scientific reviews, that they only want a 60-day review period. This is what I'm talking about. If we let nature take its course with the kind of oppressive regime that we have in office, we're going to lose so much. So I think we have to take our stand. We have to, as citizens, stand our ground in the places we love and say, life matters. Prairie dogs matter. Gray wolves matter. Ecosystems matter. And the health of the land is ultimately our own.
What is the... how do you see the human role? This is something I've been trying to think of. Are we gardeners? I mean, the word is used, stewards, but it's not a word that's very resonant for a lot of people. What is our proper role in relation to this earth that we are messing with right now?
You know, that's something I want to think about. I don't know, Mary Charlotte. You know, I mean, I think about the word guardian. I think about, as you say, the word steward. I think the word that comes to my mind is participant. You know, this world is not outside us. It's inside us. And I, you know, the question for me becomes, how do we become passionate, compassionate participants in this world, this beautiful, broken world?
Terry Tempest Williams is the author of the new book, Finding Beauty in a Broken World. Terry Tempest Williams, thank you so much for being with us and for writing this wonderful book.
And Mary Charlotte, thank you for Radio Cafe, and thank you for allowing freedom of speech to flourish.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista. Ciao.